All right, I'm here to welcome you to the BYU Students' Take on a Homogeneous Campus. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off, and I'm skipping a lot because you've all heard it about 10 times now. That's good enough. Oh, afterward, this closes at 6:30. Afterward, a lot of people are going to Crown Burger, a Utah tradition, I guess, in attending. So if you're still wondering where you want to go for dinner, Crown Burger, there's going to be a little party over there, Sunstone. Excuse me?
It's nearby.
I don't know, but I can Google that while I'm moderating, and I'll say it at the end if you need it. Okay, I'm going to introduce the presenters. First, about the presentation. In a campus environment known for its marked homogeneity, some students at BYU struggle to find a home within the ranks of Mormon orthodoxy. Four students and former students talk about their beliefs of carving out space for nuanced belief. With an array of experiences with and beliefs about the LDS Church, they will discuss the effects that BYU has had on their individual faith journeys and how they've challenged some of the dogma that exists in the BYU community. Francesca Lopez, raise your hand. Francesca Lopez is a 20-year-old senior majoring in sociology. Hey, that's what I majored in. Nice. At BYU, even, and minoring in global women's studies at BYU. She grew up in southern Texas near the Texas-Mexico border, which fueled her passion for social justice at a young age. She's a second-generation immigrant and first-generation college student. Hooray! Okay, baptized into the LDS Church at 8 years old, she has grown into her testimony after coming to BYU and critically engaging with bad policy and harmful revelation. Julia Stark, the other end, is an artist and art educator entering her fourth year at BYU. Now a self-proclaimed cafeteria Mormon, her spirituality is built upon an affinity toward the mystical, metaphysical, impossible to explain aspects of the religion she was raised in. Grant Frazier, go Grant, serves as co-president of the BYU College Democrats, the campus's largest academic club. That's impressive, the Democrats, yay. His dedication, His dedication to liberal activism within Mormonism also led him to organize BYU's first protest in over a decade, fighting against unjust procedures and practices within the school's honor code office. If you're reading the news at all, it has been huge news and very fascinating. And last but not least, Evan Jones.
It's this guy.
He is a former BYU student, now at Utah Valley University, studying anthropology, Mormonism, and psychology, preparing for graduate studies in the social sciences. His passion for the study of Mormonism stems from his faith crisis at BYU, his queer Mormon spectrum friends, and his desire to introduce nuance into a polarized religious scene. If y'all help me give a round of applause and invitation to our panel. They're going to present first, and then they'll open it up to questions. And if you have a question, please come to the microphone, because this is being recorded.
Okay. Hello. Can you hear me?
Testing.
Closer? Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay. 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 For those of you who don't know me, my name is Julia Stark. I'm entering my fourth year at BYU this fall, and I'm studying art education. So I do fine art photography, and I also do a lot of graphic design, in case you were wondering what my medium is. So my major is art education, so I'm supposed to go and become an art teacher, but I don't know what my life plan is yet. Lately, I've been coming up with this plan to move to rural Utah and just have some cows, and maybe some chickens, and I'm calling it my post-art plan. So as in, like, after art fails as a plan, this is my plan B. So I grew up in a super normal outside of Utah Mormon household. I'm from Colorado. I was one of two members in my grade at school, and there were about 20 members at my high school. So it wasn't a tiny Mormon population, but not a huge one. Unlike a lot of the people I've encountered, I always hated Mormon culture and regular social conventions at church. I didn't fit into my home ward, and the first Mormon friend I ever had was at BYU. So I'm not like some of my other friends here on this panel who grew up really engulfed in the culture, which you'll hear about more as we go along. I actually did anything I could to avoid youth activities and hanging out with Mormons in general. And no one at school knew I was Mormon, and I made sure they weren't about to find out. So interestingly, I found myself more in tune with and interested in the spiritual aspects of religion. Since I didn't ever fit in at church, it was never a cultural experience for me. So I get to BYU, and I realize that, wait a second, I don't really get along with Mormons, and this place is literally full of Mormons. I had one friend my freshman year, and I spent a lot of my first 2 years with just overwhelming amounts of anxiety, depression, and loneliness. Things like scriptures and conference talks, religion classes, and BYU devotionals became the things that I revolved my life around. There's so many scriptures and talks and lectures about how you're not alone and God is there, and if you keep the commandments and you keep them really, really well, that you'll get all the blessings in the world. And sometimes the sentiment is even that if you keep the commandments really well, you'll get exactly what you want. So for someone who spent a lot of time feeling alone as a kid and as a teen, now I'm here at BYU, just desperate for blessings, and I held on to these sentiments like nothing else. It was my rock, and it was the only thing I had. Because of this, my first 2 years of school, I had this incredibly strong, intense spiritual connection, and I was a little bit obsessed with religion because, once again, it was all I had. But the problem is that at BYU, you never get a break from being surrounded by all of this. If you want to be able to stay at BYU, you have to keep up your ecclesiastical endorsement every year, which, if you're not trying to risk your education, involves going to church every week. And if you want to graduate from BYU, you have to take 7 different religion classes. Every single thing shuts down on campus during the devotional on Tuesday mornings. You can't even stay in most places and just chill. They literally shut everything down. So you're in this bubble, and you can't ever get a break from it, ever. And this, combined with the part of the church where we tie in people's worth and their ability to how well they follow rules, this is the type of environment that very easily and intensely fosters religious OCD, or scrupulosity. So the RMs in my YSA ward said that exact obedience brings blessings. And general conference speakers say that God is merciful, but always just. And then there's this weird kind of constant pressure at BYU that because people in the church are paying tithing money for you to be here, that you have to be even more perfect. And then on top of this, I'm feeling personal failure. Like, I'm not making friends. I'm already 19, and I'm not married. I didn't get an A. I didn't get an A in American Heritage, even though I got all A's in high school, and everything feels out of control. So my brain says, and I know a lot of other people whose brains say, okay, what is something we can control? Because the church is all about agency, right? And the place my brain went with this was that I must not be keeping the commandments well enough. That must be the problem. So I get into this mindset, and I just know that if I keep the commandments perfectly, everything will get better. Everyone at BYU seems so happy all the time, and that was impossible for me to achieve, and I was convinced that I must be doing something wrong to deserve it, and they must all be keeping the rules better than me. So if I was super tired and I forgot to read my scriptures one night or something, I would be convinced that I just screwed up again, and I probably wouldn't have anything good happen to me for a couple of months because of that mistake. And that if I had been perfect at keeping the commandments, that I would have everything I wanted in my life and nothing would be going wrong anymore. And then something bad would happen, and it would just reinforce these thought patterns. Like, I got a bad grade, so I need to focus in and be even more perfect because during that class, I missed reading my scriptures a few times, and now look what happened. I believe that God was punishing me for every little mistake I made. If I didn't smile at every person I walked past, I wasn't being Christ-like enough, and something bad would happen. If I didn't pray for 15 minutes on my knees morning and night and read my scriptures for 30 minutes morning and night, something bad would happen. If I didn't go to the temple 3 days a week, something bad would happen. And if I didn't tell God I was grateful for 7 things before I asked for 1 thing, something bad would happen. Someone in one of my YSA wards said that we should be repenting every day. My understanding of repentance before my religious obsession was that you really only had to repent for really big things, and every once in a while you could just kind of blanket repent for all the little things, which I think kind of makes sense. Like, who can remember every single time they told a white lie to get out of something, or they weren't as nice to someone as they could have been, or any other tiny sin that happens throughout every normal day? But once I heard that we should be repenting every day, suddenly I had to remember all of these things because otherwise I wouldn't be correctly accessing the power of the atonement, which would mean that I wasn't being grateful for Jesus' sacrifice for me, which would mean that I wasn't clean, which would mean that I was full of mistakes, which would mean that I wasn't good enough to deserve blessings. And if I don't deserve blessings, I deserve to be punished. So to make sure I was remembering everything, I had to write everything down. And at the end of the day, I would go through the list and I would beg on my knees for forgiveness. And I had to repeat each of them twice or three times or four times just in case God wasn't listening or just in case I didn't say it right the first time. And then on the outside, everyone in my family was so proud of me for being such a good member of the church and for sacrificing so much. And this external praise adds to the feedback loop and everything gets worse. So this is how easily these things spiral out of control. I didn't even experience severe scrupulosity. I know people at BYU who have compulsions like washing their hands until they bleed because their religion makes them feel like they're never clean. Or they have repetitive, intrusive thoughts that God hates them and is going to send them to hell. Or they develop an eating disorder because the only thing in their life that they can control is what they put in their body. And if they feel like they've messed up, they punish themselves by refusing themselves food. But when it comes to any type of religious obsession, the line between being a good Mormon who isn't obsessive and being a good Mormon who is obsessive is scarily thin. I didn't notice anything was wrong for so long because it's kind of normal to be like this at BYU. It's that bubble. Everything there that is so abnormal feels so normal. So it took me a while and a lot of therapy, but I realized that everything I was doing was really unhealthy and harmful to myself. So I stopped being a perfect Mormon. I stopped going to church every single week. Nothing bad happened. I stopped praying for 30 minutes, morning and night, on my knees. Nothing bad happened. I stopped taking the words of prophets and apostles, and even sometimes BYU professors, as the literal words of God that were made specifically for me to obey and follow. Nothing bad happened. I skipped a few devotionals. I got some tattoos. I did things for myself. Nothing bad happened. This was all really important for me. I had to rewire my brain to believe that the world wouldn't actually end if I didn't follow every rule and commandment perfectly. When you get this deep into religious obsession, taking a step back is a way of survival. And I want to repeat that because most of the Orthodox Mormons in my life don't understand this, but taking a step back is a way of survival. So it's been about a year since then in a lot of ways. My life still kind of sucks. I still have the anxiety and the depression. I've actually gotten more mentally ill since I stopped being a perfect Mormon, which messes with my head a lot because it's like, oh my gosh, this is happening because I got those tattoos. I shouldn't have done that, you know? It carries with you. But what I guess I've learned since then is that every member of the church really is a cafeteria Mormon, or in other words, a Mormon who picks and chooses what parts of the church they want to follow and to what extent and the order of importance they want to rank everything in. And that realization kind of changed things for me, because that's when I realized that even the really perfect Mormons were still probably not eating meat sparingly, and they might have been participating in some loud laughter from time to time, and you get what I'm saying. So during this journey away from Mormon orthodoxy, I also found that unorthodoxy exists everywhere at BYU. I wish that at 17 years old, when I was so alone, and all of the other BYU students in the margins who are so alone, could see that unorthodoxy and nuance, but it all has to hide out of the fear of getting in trouble. But behind closed doors, there are progressive professors at BYU, and there's an underground ex-Mormon community, and I can't even tell you how many people get wasted on Saturday night and then put on their church clothes and go to church Sunday morning. It's a place full of so much cognitive dissonance and confusion and dishonesty, and no one from the outside knows about any of it because the church needs BYU to be its perfect university. I even heard that during graduation week, they spray paint the grass to be greener. Maybe that's symbolic. I don't know.
Well, thank you all for coming today. My name's Evan Jones. I use he, him pronouns. I go to UVU. I study Mormonism and anthropology and psychology. I grew up in Northern Virginia. Is this loud enough? Okay. I grew up in Northern Virginia. And again, this is all of our first time presenting at Sunstone. And I think this is all of our first time attending a summer symposium. And so I'm really happy to be here. Some background about me. I was born in the covenant, baptized at age 8. My family was and still is very active in the church. My grandfather was called to be a stake patriarch a couple years ago and works now as a temple sealer. I got my Eagle Scout when I was 14. Got my duty to God. I was in youth quorum presidencies. I visited all of the major Mormon history sites. I went on splits with the missionaries regularly. All of my close friends were active Latter-day Saints as well. I graduated from seminary with a near-perfect attendance record, and I memorized my scripture mastery scriptures, and I was a full tithe payer. I was even a Republican. I played piano for my stakes youth conference at the Kirtland Temple, inside the temple. So that's a little bit of background on my faith growing up. And before I get into my presentation, I want to mention that despite having a lot of similar experiences as other Latter-day Saints, I absolutely cannot speak for anyone as a whole. I can't speak for post-Mormons. I can't speak for non-normative faith Mormons, agnostic Mormons. And I can't speak to the experiences of people of color, queer folks, and women on the Mormon spectrum. And there's a ton of information out there, and there's so many people who are from marginalized groups who have shared their stories about their experiences with Mormonism, and I really encourage you to listen to those perspectives. So with that, here's the story of how BYU made me an agnostic socialist Mormon. I really could spend the whole 90 minutes talking about BYU shortcomings and talking about how it's failed its most vulnerable students for 150 years, but I'm gonna stay focused, and I need to preface by saying that I loved my 2 years at BYU. I spent 2 years there, transferred to the University of Utah, spent a year there, and I'm now transferring to Utah Valley University to finish my degree. And I had amazing professors, and I made lasting friendships, and But if BYU didn't have its problems, we wouldn't be sitting here presenting about it. And I also need to say that I'm very much happy and at peace with where I'm currently at in my faith journey, but it was very hard at BYU. So I want to get into my faith crisis that I had as a first semester BYU freshman. And I'd love to say that it was precipitated by, you know, some big event or some like huge enlightening realization, but it was really just a slow and really painful process, to be honest. My first semester was spent preparing for a full-time mission, like a lot of other BYU students. Ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to go to BYU, and I wanted to serve a full-time mission for the church. And I didn't apply to any other schools besides BYU and BYU-Idaho. And so when I first got here to BYU, I was really stunned to realize that I was surrounded by people who were just intensely spiritual and just seemingly perfect in all aspects of their lives. And so I decided that I needed to get to their level before I was ready for a mission. And so I felt a lot of that push and that drive to be perfect that Julia was talking about. And so I realized that I didn't have that requisite connection with God that I previously assumed that I had. And so I was praying and searching and studying for, you know, really intensely for many weeks, and that just yielded zero results. And during this time and during the subsequent weeks and months, I just had to take a step back and seriously reconsider all of my beliefs and my values and just my whole life. And so I decided that I didn't believe in the truth claims of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then I decided that not only was it false, but it was a harmful organization run by these evil, senile old men. And my freshman year it was going so fast, I didn't have time to process all of these new feelings, and I just tried to brush them aside, you know, so I could focus on like class and my grades and being depressed and whatnot. and then towards the end of my freshman year at BYU, my girlfriend of two semesters and I broke up because of our faith differences, and she ended up going on a mission. I started my second year, and it was difficult as I grappled with whether I wanted to be at BYU as a non-believing student. I had very few friends with whom I could actually be open about my experiences. Like I made a lot of friends at BYU, but you know, they all of them I kind of had to like not tell all of you know, my faith beliefs and journey too. Most of my first 2 years was spent, you know, telling these little small lies to people who wouldn't be accepting if they knew what I actually believed. And this got harder as I reached the end of my freshman year, and all of my male friends and almost all of my female friends got mission calls, and I did not. And I thought I could handle it, but these little things started to build up, and I had no outlet for discussion of my faith journey besides folks who have strong negative feelings towards the church. And I also had no idea that BYU had just like this, I guess, underground, you know, population of progressive members of the church, like these folks who are also struggling to fit in BYU and in the campus environment. And so I wouldn't realize this for a while, actually. And so the anxiety that I felt daily about being at BYU as a non-normative faith student just led me to transfer. But luckily, right as this was going on, I met Julia, and she was able to add a lot of nuance to my beliefs, and her perspectives on faith and our religious experiences really changed my life. And now, 3 years after stepping foot on the Lord's University as a brand new freshman, I've never felt more comfortable in my uncertainty. As it turns out, BYU students with crises of faith have few resources to which they can turn, and so I felt forced into this opposite extreme that I'd been living in. Many folks find refuge in r/ex-Mormon on Reddit. You know, I'd read that subreddit every night before I went to bed. I felt a strong sense of superiority as I read it, and I'm sure some folks can relate to that. I personally found that post-Mormon communities can be both very healing, but also very harmful for people with ongoing faith crises and for people in very demanding Latter-day Saint environments. So I went to some meetups with some other post-Mormons, and they're always like shrouded in paranoia and secrecy, you know, and they kind of just made me more angry and more scared. And so I experienced firsthand what post-Mormons go through, and I experienced my persecution complex being fueled by BYU. And that just furthered my bitterness towards the school and towards just the people there. But there are obviously so many folks who have it a lot worse. There are many students who literally feel unsafe on campus, and their fear and their distrust is valid, and it's amplified by a history of non-inclusion and persecution. So I want to now draw attention to how queer students are oppressed at BYU. BYU in 2019 does not have any resources for its LGBTQ students, nor does it allow any LGBTQ clubs to meet on its premises. Gay relationships and expressions of love are not allowed, and there's ambiguous language in the honor code that allows for further unfair treatment on an individual level. While queer students are facing systemic discrimination at BYU, they're also very acutely aware of BYU's actions in the past 6 decades. And this includes BYU professors and therapists and administrators sanctioning and practicing conversion therapy from at least 1959 through at least 1995, with some BYU professors even encouraging conversion therapy today. In the 1960s, BYU began to expel students whom they thought might be gay, and student ward bishops in the 1960s also began to breach confidentiality in interviews and would report gay or suspected gay students to BYU administration. Students of color face intense oppression daily, and the Honor Code Office has a history of treating BYU students of color poorly. And because of this and the fact that instructors at BYU of color make up just 6% of BYU faculty, white students very rarely hear the perspectives that we desperately need to hear. And speaking of BYU faculty, they can feel to some extent fear and distrust from their own administration. Historically, they've been very limited in what they're allowed to say and believe and research. Professors need to be temple-worthy, and their accounts of administration policing tithe-paying of faculty. D. Michael Quinn in the 90s was pressured to resign after publishing a 100-plus page article about Mormon history that is now the accepted narrative by the church. BYU administration in the 1990s kept a list of faculty on whom they'd keep a close eye. In general, levels of academic freedom are just dangerously low, and we don't have time to get to all of that. We don't have time to unpack that, but one fun quote from Bruce C. Hafen is that he says that BYU, quote, embraces all truth, but gives priority to the truths that lead to Christ. And so one of the reasons why I decided to leave BYU is to pursue academic interests that BYU might find too edgy. And so all of these actions, just this culmination of, decades and decades of oppression haven't been forgotten, and these series of events have shaped the ways that students perceive their school and the way that they perceive its exercise of authority. And so all these facts challenge my ideas of what I thought college was going to be and what its purpose is. Going into college, I believe that all students shouldn't leave the same university believing the same thing. That idea has been talked about by leaders of the church. In a BYU devotional in 1997, Marilyn Bateman said that Satan would have us believe that we should all be cast from the same mold. We should look alike, act alike, and even think alike to be in style or to be correct. And Neil Maxwell, in a BYU devotional in 96, said that righteousness lends itself to individuality. But many students involved with and at BYU, including myself, felt that the goal of the university was not, in fact, to foster individuality, but I actually found that BYU made me personally afraid of learning new information about my faith. And so despite all of this, I still love BYU. It's a great place. There are a lot of great folks, a lot of great professors there, and some of my closest friends are current BYU students. And somehow BYU just breeds this resiliency, in students who don't quite fit in. And we have so many students who want BYU to change. I talk to a lot of people about BYU's culture, and they'll say, I hate BYU's culture. So many people want BYU's culture to change, but when substantive ideas are brought to the table by students who are really just in deep pain and who are really struggling, they turn against them. And we saw this with the Restore Honor movement when the movement started to talk about the reality that queer BYU students face. People would turn away from it and say, oh, that's too liberal. I can't get behind that. You're going against the doctrines of the church. So when I have these discussions with people from BYU about BYU's challenges, they'll ask me, what I'd like to see happen at the university. And so a couple of things that I'd like to see would be for BYU to tell the truth about its history. It doesn't help anyone when administration's lying about its actions or trying to hide information. And I'd love to see BYU issue real apologies, although apologies won't fix everything. And I like to see BYU invite speakers from a wider variety of backgrounds for devotionals and forums and to diversify the BYU staff and the professors there. And for diversity training to be made standard for faculty and for the Honor Code office. And speaking of the Honor Code, we do need radical Honor Code change, which Grant will probably talk about in his 15 minutes. And we can also talk about that in the Q&A. But I just wanted to kind of wrap up by saying that change comes when we listen to the most vulnerable students on campus at BYU, or just in general. It comes when we listen to the most vulnerable people in the church. You know, we, white straight men in the BYU administration building, are not going to heal the wounds that BYU's inflicted, and we're not going to get anywhere by asking people who don't face oppression at BYU about change. And so I'd like to invite everyone here to read about and listen to and talk to folks on the Mormon spectrum who have been forced into the margins in our faith tradition. M. Russell Ballard gave some advice on this, which was to, quote, listen to and understand our LGBTQ siblings, and I'd add our siblings of color. And as we do that, we'll be able to learn more than we could really imagine, and we'll be able to further develop love and empathy. And so with that, I'd like to turn the time over to Grant.
Hello. Oh, sorry, we got applause. Yeah. So hello, everyone. Yeah, I'm Grant. I'll just get right into it. I grew up in Alpine, Utah, which, for those of you who don't know, is like the Mormon bubble within the Mormon bubble of Utah County, which is the Mormon bubble within Utah. So it's 99% Mormon, and everybody in my neighborhood was Mormon. I knew everybody's last name from all the fast offerings deliveries I did. None of my childhood best friends lived farther than two blocks away from me. I saw them every week at church. And I can't think of a time that I had a single conversation that was substantive or meaningful with a person outside of the Mormon faith until I was 14 or 15, like really, really late. And so I went to American Heritage School as well. So if anybody doesn't, anybody know what that is? Any American Heritage fans? Yeah. So great. Thank you. Well, someone who knows it. Yeah. So American Heritage School is a Mormon faith-based private school in American Fork, Utah that also, in addition to that, they teach fundamental conservative ideals. So you got like George Washington praying right next to Jesus, and like the Family Proclamation and then the Constitution. Like you got them all side by side. It mixes together. So I'm not any stranger to homogenous environments, you know. I did not experience much of anything except for white conservative Mormon until I was around 14 years old when I moved to North Carolina with my family. And I was the perfect golden boy Mormon kid in my ward, you know. When I was in Alpine, I, like, winced at swear words every time I heard them. I cried to myself because I accidentally watched parts of R-rated movies, and I thought that, like, I was going to hell because I couldn't get it out of my mind. Like, it was there. I had already seen it. And just everything in my life, like, I didn't realize it at the time, but it was all filtered through a very religious lens, you know, just as a lot of fundamental Mormon, yeah. But so the summer before my junior year, I moved to North Carolina, and that was the biggest culture shock I've ever felt, ever. And I know that culture shock's kind of a weird word to use, but my school was called Cape Fear Academy, and the kids called it Vape Fear Academy because of all the kids there who had e-cigarettes, and that was... They would use them in the bathroom, and every time I'd go into the bathroom, I had to, like, prepare myself, say a little prayer, and then just run straight to the stall. It was such a terrifying new experience to me, you know, to meet these kids outside of Mormonism. But after a while, North Carolina, it made me realize just all the things about Mormonism that were weird or interesting that I had never thought about before. You know, people would ask me all of those fun, like, absurd Mormon misconception questions that I had only heard, like, stories about in Utah, you know, like how many moms I had, animal sacrifices in temples, that was a fun one. Horns, have you guys heard that one? You know that Mormons have horns? And my favorite one, though, was people thought that we had a bunch of kids in our church because we were training a militia to overtake the country eventually. Like, we're going to get the kids. And I think it's interesting. Is that not the plan?
That was the
1800s. That's the 1800s plan. Okay, yes. But yeah, and so like every other person in high school, I came to the school and I was wildly insecure, too. And so on top of having to deal with actually thinking about my religion for the first time, I was dealing with all this outside pressure about it. And so somewhere along this like very insecure and tumultuous emotional ride of thinking about all this, I found the church history essays, and then I read the CES letter, and I felt that like deep sense of betrayal that comes from like a raw ex-Mormon, and you know, I, the golden boy of my Alpine ward, the quorum president, and a proud Eagle Scout, I lost my faith completely. It was almost overnight. It just fell away over the course of a month sometime in November of my junior year. It was quick. I fell down the ex-Mormon rabbit hole. I joined the r/ex-Mormon community, as Evan did as well. And this group just, I thought it opened up my eyes to such a big world at that time. You know, people were drinking coffee, and they'd been like me at one point, but they were doing these things that I'd always thought I couldn't do, and it was empowering to see this. And so I fell into r/ex-Mormon for a long time. Like, I would check it very religiously, but sorry. and I know that the story of the CES letter wielding recent ex-Mormon is one that you've heard before, so I don't want to like talk about that too much. yeah, I don't know. I don't want to go too much more into that, but somebody once told me that you can leave the church, but you can't make it leave you, and that's something that I've thought about a lot since I began my faith transition, just the idea that I found this a lot after being an r/ex-Mormon for a long time, seeing it felt ironic that so much of the content in the community is based on this idea. They talk about how they're free thinkers and they're not controlled by the LDS church anymore. But over time, and after being there for a while, I started to feel like it had that same Mormon groupthink that I had wanted to escape originally, and that echo chamber behavior just that they criticize within the church is prevalent still within the community that they exist in. It kind of becomes, I call it like a Band-Aid religion a little bit, r/ex-Mormon. It was great and cathartic for me while I was going through this initial faith crisis, but after a while, it didn't feel like it wasn't the right place for me. And obviously, I think it's a great group for anybody who needs it, and it helped me a lot. But it was honestly even more hurtful, I feel like, to realize that the r/ex-Mormon wasn't the place for me, because I had just up and left everything, and I had put all my cards in that deck, and then it wasn't the right place. And that kind of sent me into my limbo state that I'm still kind of going through the faith crisis. I think it's going to be happening for a while. It's just a bunch of mini crises that happen, you know, once a month maybe. But so I think I differ from the people on this panel in that I actually applied to BYU as an ex-Mormon. I wasn't Mormon at the time of application. Please don't tell this to BYU, okay? I know the audio is going to be there, but don't call them. I'm just going to wing it on this one. I'm just going to hope that we'll be fine. It was like, I knew that I would go there and it wouldn't be my favorite place in the world. I was kind of, you know, cynical, like a lot of recent ex-Mormons. I had a little bit of a superiority complex, I can say now. Like, I thought I was better because I didn't believe in this thing that all these people believed in. I thought I was smarter than them for having realized it. But I thought, I can handle BYU. I grew up in Alpine, you know? And so I started thinking a lot about this idea of the echo chamber while I was at BYU. Because I still kind of went on r/ex-Mormon. It was less and less, but I still just wanted to be not entirely in BYU culture. And I'd see the posts they'd give about BYU students and the experience that they have there, and they would say some things that were just like far outside of the realm of what I have ever experienced as an ex-Mormon. They'd say that there were like spies who watched your move at BYU, and like they'd find you if you were at coffee shops off campus. You know, they'd say that like people are investigated if they miss a week of church, and like it's secret investigations going on. Just a lot of fear-mongery language that isn't true at all. And I went into BYU terrified, much like Evan did, because of the fact that I thought that that was what it was like. I thought I was going to have to be sneaky and secret all the time. So I decided that that was what I was going to do. I kind of isolated myself completely for the fall semester. I just thought, I've got to rough through it. If anybody knows that I have a different thought than them on religion, they're going to call the honor code police on me, and they're going to get me out of here immediately. And so it was just, the fall was a really rough time for me in that sense, and I was still trying to figure all this out. And it was the most emotionally trying experience that I've had in my long 18 years on Earth, but it taught me that it's easy to exist in an echo chamber in any environment. It's easy to fall into any echo chamber, but Mormonism really primes you for it. You know, you learn early on to trust authority, do what you're told, and your sense of morality is really just complexly intertwined with your sense of spirituality. And that was the hardest thing for me. You know, in high school, being a senior and being ex-Mormon, I just struggled to find out what I thought was right, because I knew what was right and wrong for Mormonism, but I didn't know which things translated into the larger world around me. And I feel like I'm still figuring it out. I feel like I'm still there. But I was always kind of aware of the effect that r/ex-Mormon had on me at BYU, making me paranoid, but I think like the April protests really made it very clear to me exactly what that community was making me feel. Segue. I took charge in planning a protest at BYU against the Honor Code office this year. And to give a bit of the context for folks who don't know all that much about it, in April of this year, there was an Instagram page called Honor Code Stories that posted anonymous stories of BYU students who had had traumatic or difficult experiences with the Honor Code office. And some of them are just truly horrible. I encourage you all to go check it out because it's really important to know about. Over the course of about a week, this page got 30,000 followers, and it was all that anybody on campus talked about. For a brief moment, everybody was just discussing this all the time. You'd walk across campus and hear it. The EFY guy, never mind, I was going to make a joke. The kids who wear EFY shirts even when they're like 22, but I just executed it poorly. But thank you. Thank you for the laugh. Awesome. So a group of students, me included, we decided to plan a protest of the school's honor code office. And from conception to execution of the event, it was a two-week time span. And I feel like I aged 30 years during that because I thought, 2 weeks, that's enough. You just got to tell people to come and it all works out. I spent like I slept 4 hours a night for the majority of those 2 weeks, and there were two nights that I just didn't sleep at all. Like just planning this, there's so much that goes into it, especially at BYU, you know, because we, the way that we ended up doing it, this is a fun little story that I didn't write down, but I want to share it. So I wanted to have a protest on BYU's campus, but that's illegal because they're a private university. But because news media started talking about it early on, like as we initially released our flyer, we had kind of the media backing, and it was already, I had already told them that we were going to do the protest on the campus, even though I hadn't gotten that confirmed. And like BYU, I was told that the police might come if that situation happened, and I thought, that's not good. And so I ended up talking to the dean of students at BYU, and I said, okay, so here's what's going to happen. We are going to do the protest on campus, and you can kick us off the campus. You can get the BYU police to kick us off, but we have, like, national media outlets who are going to be there, and I will make sure that they take pictures of it. And that was enough. They gave us the license we needed. Usually it takes, like, a month to get an event planned in advance. Thank you. They did it in, like, 5 days. It was great. It was a fun little moment. Yes, so thank you for that. And so it was just a big thing meeting with all these honor code office officials. And I feel like when I started out with the protest, I didn't know exactly what changes we were going to make because there's so many. And I think that everyone at BYU supports some type of honor code change, whether it's, you know, the very Mormon guys who just want to be able to have a beard or, you know, the students who are actually suffering, you know, because of like discrimination, LGBTQ students, as Evan so greatly touched on in his presentation, yeah, in his little minute. But anyway, so we had news articles that appeared in Newsweek, the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, and it was just absolutely insane because none of us expected it to be like that at all. We didn't expect that this was an issue that would resonate on a national scale. But because of that, BYU's actually been making changes in recent months, and they're nothing close to what we're hoping for, but I was told by somebody, I can't remember who, while I was planning it, that when you want something to happen at BYU, you fight really hard, you fight, you give it 100%, and then you get 10%, and then you do it again the next year. You just keep going.
It's tithing.
Tithing. It's tithing, exactly. Thank you. So another fun protest story is I went into this really headstrong and naive. I thought that it would be fun for me to do an Ask Me Anything, an AMA, on the r/ex-Mormon subreddit, bringing that back. I did this because a friend told me that the subreddit, they were talking about the protest, about how some apostate kid was planning an event to try to let kids do drugs and have sex on campus whenever they want to, without abandon. And that wasn't our goal. That was not the point. So I saw that these views were like deterring some BYU students from supporting us, and so I naively thought, hey, I'll go in, I'll just say, ask me anything, I'm Grant, and I'll clear things up. And the people were, like, really great to me, actually. But I think that they all said something similar to me, and that was not only was I going to get expelled for planning it, but they all thought that I was going to get excommunicated, too. And that was, like, I kind of got scared about it, but it took, like, I think maybe a week for me to realize just how ridiculous that was, how that wasn't even in the realm of possibility. And it just was a reminder to me of that kind of fear-mongering culture that can exist, even though I don't think it's intentional at all. I think that it's just people who are going through this belief change, and it can be a big thing, and I absolutely understand it, but I just learned that that community had a negative effect on me after a while, and it's one that I had to let go. Fun story, Sam Young, he hopped into the AMA to also tell me that I was probably going to get expelled and excommunicated. So thank you, Sam. and so this was like, let's see, a few commenters here and there that called me an immoral hack for choosing to go to BYU in the first place, but I ignored those. You know, you just got to get through it. Most people there were really kind and supportive, but I was pretty sure it was just because they thought I was trying to bring down the church. And so I understood their concerns as a former member of the community, but as I came to the end of my freshman year, the experience that they assumed I had as a freshman ex-Mormon at BYU just was so far off from anything that actually happened to me. Excuse me. And it's been like a weird year for sure, and there's been a lot, and they were right that it's something that you have to think about, and there's a lot of there are a lot of hard things, but I'm like in a very happy agnostic Mormon place right now, and I'm loving it, and I think that being in this community of fun, nuanced BYU students has helped me to move past these two echo chambers that I was kind of bouncing between and learn that I can choose how I want to do it. I can be a little bit of a cafeteria Mormon if we're tying it back to that. Anyways, sorry, this has been a long and meandering way of saying that I'm a BYU student and I'm just still trying to reprogram my brain, and I've had some fun and done a protest along the way, and we're going to keep fighting for honor code changes this year. I'm trying to overcome that susceptibility to communal binary type thinking, and I've been to both extremes in my theological beliefs, and I think that it's great because now I just get to explore the middle ground, and there's a lot more in the middle, I think, than on either extreme. And lastly, real quick, I just want to touch on being the president of BYU Democrats and the experience that that's been for me. I'm the co-president of that club, and it's like, it's great because I feel like that's my space. That's the space that isn't as homogenous as a lot of spaces on campus. It's actually a very active group. We have 250 club members, and it's the largest academic club that our school has, and we get like 60, 70% attendance at all of our events of the club members. It's just a group of people who really care about this, and I've met so many different types of people. You've got moderate Democrats all the way to socialists, like communists, you know, classical Marxists. We've got a few of those. It's just, it's really nice to be in a space at BYU where I think Democrat is kind of a nice pool term for everybody who isn't the traditional Mormon. And a lot of people who come to our events, I've had people come up and say, I'm not even a Democrat. I just wanted to meet some different people at BYU. And so that's nice. Let's see. And I think that another big thing that BYU's taught me is that I can be friends with Mormons, ex-Mormons, and never-Mormons because they all have an experience. And as I'm trying to explore my faith crisis, I think everybody has something that they can offer. And to try and dismiss any group and have a superiority complex, think that ex-Mormons are all hateful and cynical or Mormons are all naive and dumb, it's just, it's a very generalizing, stereotyping way to go about it. And I'm really happy to be here at Sunstone and learn about all the different ways to Mormon. And I think there's something to be said about going into a place that's very homogenous and trying to be not homogenous, you know, because that's the only way a place changes, if new views are inserted. And that's really my presentation. Thank you all for listening.
I was jumping around a lot, so you got the idea of that, you know?
I'm going to time myself so I don't talk longer than I'm supposed to. So I'm Francesca Lopez. My pronouns are she, her, and I just want to make a quick mention. If you have the program with the schedule on it, there is a section, I think it's on the first page, that talks about honoring Native lands, and I think it's really important that we all read it. Anyways, yeah, so I'll get started. just a disclaimer, I'll be referencing heavily from Ignacio M. Garcia's wonderful essay titled Thoughts on Latino Mormons, Their Afterlife, and the Need for a New Historical Paradigm for Saints of Color. By the way, I have a QR code that it's like a list we compiled of resources that we think are really helpful. And they range a top, like a it's like a large range of things, but if you want it, you can come to talk to me after and I'll show it to you. But this essay is on there in case you want the full title. Okay. So in his essay, he describes his experience about being Latinx in the LDS faith, and I find his insights incredibly relatable. And just another disclaimer, though neither of us speak for our entire racial demographic, I find this essay to be one of the best for understanding a very complex perspective. One of my favorite quotes that he has in this essay that is kind of his theme for the entire thing and what I'll pull from is, quote, LDS views of God's work have become confined by American racialism, laws, and middle-class social values. I'll stick mostly to racialism. I won't repeat my bio, but suffice it to say, I grew up in a largely Hispanic community, and I always saw the LDS faith through a Mexican-American lens. In primary, we used to sing, once there was a Sandman who was eventually washed away when the tide came in. Fringe doctrine about us all being white in the celestial kingdom didn't really make it to me in Young Women and Relief Society lessons. I assume because had my brown-skinned teachers heard of these tales, they probably thought it not worth mentioning. It was easy to love a God that loved me just how I was when everyone I knew told me that they did. By the way, I use they-them pronouns for God because I believe it to be Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother. Anyways, it wasn't until I moved to Provo and began attending at BYU that I noticed this wasn't true in everyone's mind. Needless to say, when I got to BYU, I had several questions. First of all, if this was the Lord's campus, and in my mind, symbolic of how the peak of the church community would appear, why were there so little people of color? For context, BYU is 82% white, 6% Hispanic, 4% unknown, 4% multi-ethnic, 3% Asian/Pacific Islander, 1% Black, and less than 1% Native American. And to give further context, I went on a humanitarian trip to Nepal last year, and I had less culture shock than when I went to BYU. Nepal. Now, I'm not dumb. I knew what I was getting myself into when I signed up to go to BYU. I saw the pamphlets, and I saw pictures of campus, and I saw white people. But I did my research. Despite having to choose from a list of random roommates, I picked the only other woman of color on the floor that I wanted. Although Annie wasn't particularly politically active, we became fast friends, and I taught her my feminist ways. She had a similar story to mine. She was half Taiwanese and grew up on the outskirts of the Bay Area in California, a highly Asian area. We bonded over the culture shock we were both experiencing. During my time at BYU, I found several communities to help me deal with the several different transitions that were happening in my life my freshman year. The Women of Color Club on campus helped my transition into such a white school. My friends and roommate helped my transition from a low-key Democratic Molly Mormon to someone who was suddenly facing a lot of new questions about what she believed. The final transition, which I won't spend much time on, is that of my sexuality, which Twitter and Women's March Provo helped me with. In regard to my transition to a largely racially homogenous campus, my experiences are very much my own, and though I have bonded with several other people of color over the issues I have faced there, my opinions are no way indicative of the entire minority group at BYU. Growing up, I hadn't paid much attention to what Garcia in his essay calls the, quote, top-down, white-to-brown dichotomy of the church. Though looking back, I'm not surprised. I learned to view myself and other people of color as second tier to my white brethren. Suarez, as far as I know, is the first Latinx member of the 12. Ever. This lack of representation is not unique to LDS leadership, but we ain't got time to talk about all that right now. This lack of representation, however, has had serious consequences. Harmful doctrine ranging from the tribe of Ephraim ruling over Manassas to the false idea that everyone will be white in the celestial kingdom all pile onto Latinx members' experiences that further prove to us that we are destined to be what Garcia calls, quote, stepsons and stepdaughters of a loving God, just not one that loves us quite as much as their white children. Excuse me. Garcia describes how the teaching that Ephraim will rule over Manassas perpetuates the notion that Latinx saints are becoming, quote, white and delightsome through obedience. By the way, a friend of mine, Ashley, did a poll on Twitter last month to see how pervasive the narrative is that we'd all be white in heaven, and her results are as follows. Out of 1,319 votes, 60% said they had heard this teaching before, and 34 specified that it was an outright declaration that white would be the celestial race. Side note, that's like super cool for me who grew up hating my skin and now being mixed race is a fad. Whatever. No, it's on Twitter. It's super unscientific. Yeah. I read Garcia's essay only a few weeks ago, but my experiences at BYU fell neatly and scarily in line with Garcia's in his life as a member, bishop, and more. I experienced the typical microaggressions, breaking down in tears the first time I went to a woman of color meeting when I was finally able to speak openly about my pain and be validated by other women who knew perfectly what I was experiencing. I also had outright, unapologetic racists attempt to bully and shame me, and admittedly, most succeeded. White spaces, for those of you who may not know, are spaces typically occupied by white people and dominated by them, which minorities are required to navigate daily. For example, BYU is entirely a white space. My dorm was a safe space away from it, but as soon as I stepped outside into our hall, I was once again in a white space. It was, and still is, exhausting. There are only three places in the entirety of Provo where I feel like I'm in a safe space anymore. My room, Don Joaquin's Taco Restaurant, and Rancho Market. I realized this stark difference in white space and safe space compared to my hometown the very first day I moved to Provo when I went grocery shopping. I was walking through the Macy's grocery store, and I realized there was an aisle called Hispanic Foods. Sorry. Back home, the entire grocery was Hispanic Foods. Since that first day, the differences have only become more apparent. From strangers asking me about privilege while I eat breakfast alone in public dining areas, to classmates making comments about me eating rice and beans, I have learned I don't need to initiate arguments or conversations with racist individuals because my skin color will do it for me. I am still learning how to navigate my identity at BYU Just last semester, I had a professor who would refuse to call on me if there were other students with questions, especially if the students were white or male. Regardless of how long my hand was in the air, my professor would continue to teach, even going so far as to move on to other topics so my question became irrelevant, all while looking me in the eye, and then after my continued insistence, he would reluctantly call on me. After a while, I stopped raising my hand. I stopped engaging with his lectures. I stopped paying attention. I didn't even notice until the end of the semester when the only other woman of color in my class asked me if I had noticed our professor being rude to her, which I had. I recalled several instances in which he had unprovokingly ignored her, even ridiculed her. She breathed a sigh of relief and then explained that she was worried she had just imagined it, or maybe her feelings of anger toward him were undeserved. This is a common phenomenon for women, especially women of color. We are gaslit so much we believe we are crazy, dramatic, and too sensitive, so we learn to do it to ourselves. I guarantee that for everything a woman gets the courage up to complain about, there are several other things she shouldn't have accepted that she did. After speaking to my classmate about this and simultaneously validating one another's experiences, I realized just how much of an impact this professor's actions had had on me. This kind of intimidation, gaslighting, and abuse happens in the church all the time for Latinx saints. It's not unique to BYU. It's not even unique to the church. In Garcia's essay, he mentions an experience that describes this phenomenon. So, to give this context, he had just had a racist encounter with his stake president's wife, and a member that he was with had pulled him out of the home before he wasn't going to fight or anything, but he was getting upset. All the way home, Garcia says, the man who would later be my bishop, who had pulled him aside, and a church patriarch remained silent, fully aware, I'm guessing, that he had again, for the umpteenth time in his life, been intimidated by a white person, even one without any priesthood authority. I have found chosen families at BYU who are willing to listen, support, and validate me. They have made the difference in my decision to stay at BYU, to stay in the church even. I met Julia on Twitter after a prominent student made harmful statements against women, and she took the mantle not to back down. This individual, who will remain nameless, is not a nice person, to say the least. And Julia's bravery to take him on was inspiring to me. Here was a woman who saw something unjust occurring and didn't just take it. To a young woman of color who was only just coming into her own voice, that was revolutionary. I met Grant when Women's March Provo, which I'm vice president of, was asked to consult with his honor code reform protest, which Evan was also a part of. The first night I met Grant, I ripped him a new one for not having a diverse enough planning committee trying to reform something that specifically targets marginalized communities. His response was complete agreeance. He completely accepted my criticisms, taking the advice I offered and accepting responsibility for his actions. I met Evan a few days later when I complained about the lack of diversity in their movement once again. He responded similarly to Grant and took the responsibility to make sure their movement made meaningful change for the people who needed it the most, even if that meant less glory for them both. These are the kind of people who, although some would argue they are simple and unimpactful, have created opportunities that have been anything but simple and unimpactful for me. There are people like us all over BYU, but we're not on pamphlets, and BYU doesn't make a particularly strong effort to acknowledge that we even exist. BYU's homogeneity is harmful and leads to an echo chamber of students who all look the same and believe the same. The honor code doesn't make me feel like I attend a school with higher standards that I can appreciate. It makes me feel like they only want a single type of student that can fit easily into a controllable mold, like Evan mentioned. Despite the obvious differences between that mold and myself, being brown-haired and darker-skinned, I couldn't fit in even if I tried. That's what makes finding communities like ours, and I mean this literally, life-saving. The Women of Color Club saved my life, and people like Grant, Julia, Evan, and Genevieve, my friend who came up from Provo and is in the audience, continue to do so for me every day. BYU has given me a community of people who have empowered me to speak my truths, not back down, and own my space, but it also put me in a place where I needed to in the first place. As far as my faith transition goes, I won't speak much about it, but I'll end with a short summary of my experience. I was left-leaning in high school, particularly passionate about sexism, but didn't ever really start openly allowing myself to disagree with LDS teachings until my senior year. BYU fast-tracked my social activism and further distancing from certain parts of the church. I was suddenly launched into a world of supposedly Christ-like individuals who were all supposed to love one another, but refused to even interact with me because I was different. I quickly realized I could either assimilate or solidify my identity before others could vilify it. I chose the latter. I know who I am now, mostly. I'm a feminist, social activist, sociologist, and also a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I love the core doctrine of the church. I believe Joseph Smith was a prophet called of God. I believe in the power of the temple and more. I also believe that there is absolutely no good reason that women should not have the priesthood, and that the priesthood ban on African-American saints was a flat-out mistake. I have come to terms with the fact that sometimes truths can contradict each other and still be true. I doubt my faith crisis would have been as pronounced had I not attended BYU. It's been said we can only know happiness because we have known sadness. I'm not surprised I had to know hardcore, blind, unquestioning, problematic obedience before I knew how to find a nuanced, more fulfilling, critically engaging testimony of the faith that I love.
I went to BYU in the 1980s, and listening to you all, the first thing that struck me was how little has changed. We were founding, you know, Voice, the first feminist student group, was founded during my years there. Student Review started the winter semester of my freshman year, which was this underground student newspaper that was hugely influential on me. We had a group called Response that was kind of like liberal politics group. There was also the Eco Response, which was the environmentalist subgroup of that. We had a weekly prayer vigil for peace on the lawn between the HVAC and the Wilkinson Center. I mean, these things were all happening then, but there seems to be like no continuity from each generation is recreating all of these things when they come to BYU, and that's kind of depressing.
Yeah.
Listening to you, where it is different is that now the white boys are a little woker. And they actually listen to the women. And because it was super penis central back in the day. So happy to see that. Thank you very much for still like being engaged. And because I describe myself as a recovering BYU student. 30 years later, literally, exactly 30 years since I graduated. So
thank you so much.
Thanks so much for your stories. Really appreciate them. Learned a lot from them. A question I had was, as you interact with those that are in authority at BYU, do you think that they respond out of true empathy or out of fear?
You guys want to?
I can start.
I'll take one too. Yeah, you go first.
Okay. I obviously, like, the person on this panel who's interacted with BYU administration the most is Grant, but from what I've seen and just from what I've seen from history is that, you know, there's a wide variety of belief at BYU. Like, I've had very liberal professors and very conservative professors who don't want anything to change. I know that a lot of people in the BYU administration, some of whom we won't name, you know, don't want things to change, and some of them are fighting very, very hard. And so I'd have to assume that, you know, some of those folks are getting frustrated with the other ones, and there's a lot, so not a lot happens, you know? But Grant probably knows the most.
So actually, during the protest, I met with an unnamed BYU administrator who wouldn't let me ever share their name ever again, but they said that they would meet with me and give me some advice on planning the protest, and I thought that was kind of cool that happened, but they told me that a lot of professors supported our movement, but that even tenured professors are like at threat of being moved into a department that they don't want to be in, or moved into some dead-end job where they have no opportunity to do any of the things they wanted to. So professors...
This is why there's no continuity.
Exactly. Yeah. Professors care about these issues, but they have to worry about getting in trouble themselves. And that's... We run into that in, like, the club that... The BYU Democrats Club still, you know, it's a very tricky ground to be in. One time somebody used the Twitter account, the BYU Dems account, to like a tweet that was relating to LGBTQ issues, and a 19-year-old male student sent a two-paragraph email to the club's advising professor to say that, I've attended BYU Democrats events for the last 2 years, and I'm done now. I am, like, shocked and horrified by this. And we ended up getting in trouble for that, the presidency of BYU Democrats. So it's still a struggle. Some professors support us. They just have to lay down the law because their jobs are on the line. It's frustrating.
I also, just to comment on that as well, since there is such, like, a wide variety of professors and students at BYU who have varying levels of, like, how much they actually care about or respect the honor code, so, like, I'm an art student, right, and no one cares what we do. Like, our professors don't care. Like, they encourage us to, they encourage us to be, like, edgy and provocative and things that, you know, students and other majors and departments would definitely get in trouble for. But I also, so my older sister also went to BYU, and she was in industrial design, which is, there's a lot of artsy people in there, so it's kind of the same thing. But she had a professor who actually got in really big trouble for letting a student have blue hair. And so, yeah, it's kind of like Grant was saying, like, there's, everyone's just in fear, like, all the time. But I don't know. I chose the right place to be, I guess, artist.
Art, yeah.
I think, sorry, just a quick comment. I think, like, a distinction with that is, like, I've noticed that, like, most professors that I've met who are more, like, accepting and empathetic, I guess, to use the word that you asked the question with, the people who are less empathetic don't see a point in what we're doing. And I think it's because it can get really depressing when you realize that, like, Kevin J. Worthen is not in control of the university. It's the board, which is the apostles.
Yeah. Delaney Jokes still on that.
So unless you convince Delaney Jokes that gay people deserve rights, you're not doing anything. So
yeah. We can do it. We can get it.
I have a question. You know, I've never gone to BYU. I'm this guy.
Good choice.
And, well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we have a lot of LDS students there, but also, you know, we're more of a, you know, we're different than BYU, and thank goodness. You know, our president says we're the university for Utah. You know, I like that. But, you know, I would like to know, you know, I'm wondering if, you know, you as students that have experienced BYU that I haven't, you know, if there's a more of an underground kind of sinister kind of thing going on that they don't always tell about. What I'm referring to specifically is, you know, the change in the jurisdiction of the BYU police there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that they, you know, that they weren't handling their cases seriously, and so they turned them over into the city jurisdiction and put the BYU police under investigation and things like that. I don't know if you had experienced that, and if you could tell us more about what was going on as far as this situation with the BYU police department down there.
Okay, so I'll go first just because, okay, so just this past winter semester at BYU, I was actually blackmailed with the Honor Code office by another student, and I was told that if I didn't stop talking about this student and them doing negative things, that he would report me and my friends to the Honor Code office, and he did, and we ended up getting a lot of help from Title IX, and they're really great and really awesome. But we also were trying to get help from BYU police because there's, like, some weird impersonation and just the blackmail.
Fake social media accounts.
Yeah. And BYU police, the best way that we've described them is as rent-a-cops. they're terrible. They're terrible. So when we found out they were losing their accreditation or whatever, that was no surprise, and I'm very glad it's happening. But BYU has a really long history of using BYU police to, get into the Honor Code office. And so one of the examples that stands out to me is that back in the 70s, they would send, like, BYU police people to gay bars in Salt Lake City. And, yeah, in the 80s. Yeah. Yeah. And they would write down, like, license plate numbers and then bring in the students who had been at gay bars and, like, interrogate them. So they have, like, a really long history of this stuff. So I think it's no surprise they're finally coming to an end, and we're all very happy about that.
Yeah. And just to add to that, Art, Julia's experience, I was So I was there for a lot of it, and what BYU police eventually told Juliet to do with this student who had blackmailed her was to just turn him into the honor code office himself, and so which we didn't do.
No.
So. And fun fact, actually, a BYU police officer this last year was fired, and I think there was like a trial. I don't know how the trial ended up, but he was taking Orem and Provo City police records and using them to get kids in trouble with the honor code office. Big no-no. Yes, yes. Okay, that was. Mm-hmm. Big things. Mm-hmm. That's just it was lots of overreach, you know.
Yeah. Also, BYU police. I'm not gonna go into detail. It's been like revealed that they would like when they were called to help victims of sexual assault, they would turn in the names to the honor code office. So, just go to Provo police. I've dealt with them and they're really cool. Better option, in my opinion.
I am a graduate student at BYU.
Hey,
I'm
nice.
Also a recent convert.
Fellow coup.
And I would join the church and went to BYU because I thought it would be full of people like you. Maybe not full, but at least that I could find them.
You and me both.
You found us.
Found you now.
You found
Let's
us.
Let's hang. Are you on Twitter?
Yeah, not
you gotta
enough,
be.
Apparently.
That's where we'll meet us.
That's the place.
So I am disheartened but also optimistic because of you guys. And I really saw BYU as at least having the potential to live up to all the wonderful things that I see about the church and about what it can accomplish with the university. How do you think we'll get there? Because we're not there right now. And if it is, you know, the knowledge that is God's gift to earth and humans, and that if that's what we're going to be working on at BYU, when will the academic freedom and civil rights issues and all of that, what has to change to for BYU to epitomize what it should?
Hold on, can I just talk first on this? I think that it's not going to happen. How do I say this politically correct? It's not going to happen when there are white men who are straight and cisgender and able-bodied in positions of power. Exclusively in positions of power.
And just with the protests, I think, like, absolutely, that's, like, literally it, pretty much. But I think grassroots education, like, the students, the people who have these beliefs, because people who don't have these beliefs, again, like Julia mentioned, they don't realize that these are issues even. The problem at BYU has been that people don't recognize, they're unwilling to recognize that there are problems, and it was what we ran into with the protest. Up until then, we had only heard positive responses, and the day of it and afterward, it was a lot of negative feedback. People just saying, leave this school, it doesn't make sense, go to a different university. Yeah, it's a lot of work, but I think if we protest enough and we get the national media to keep covering this school when they do bad things, that's, I think, one of the best ways to keep them in check at that level. Anyway.
Yeah, and I think, like Grant said, national news media covering stuff like the Honor Code protest and covering stuff, BYU doesn't like to see that. So in response to your question, I was going to make a joke that we're like 3, maybe 4 funerals away from like radical change at BYU, but I'm not going to make that joke. My parents are going to be listening to this. I didn't make that joke, but like that's what came to my head. You know, I think it's just our generation's just on something else. You know, and as soon as you know, younger folks, and people who are more progressive start to take positions of power, and obviously people from marginalized groups, like that's when actual change can happen.
Just real quick, this is a little random, but just point of clarification so I don't get expelled. I was an agnostic Mormon by the time I started BYU, so I wasn't faking it there. BYU, if you're hearing this, parents, I love you guys. There we go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let the record show.
Hey, thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
We share something in common. I'm a BYU grad, class of 1990. So unless you're 29 years old, you were not born at that time. I manage off-campus student housing at the outskirts of a different university.
Okay.
And while I'm not a student, and my next comment is somewhat anecdotal because I only know the students under my houses that I manage, my impression is that when they form their study groups, regardless of their college majors, they get in groups of a half dozen roughly, and then they might say to themselves, hey, we're all the same, meaning we're all white or we're all male. Let's break up and bring in someone into our study group who's not like us. Bring in a minority, whether it's a change of gender or race or whatever. So they're not simply copies of themselves, whatever that might be. Even if they're all, you know, native-born Hispanic students, they want to bring a native English speaker. You get my point, regardless of which way this can go. Yet, I've heard, you know, some of the pain, particularly you, Francesca, that spoke of the pain of being the minority, and as if your minority is something that you can't celebrate, that it's suppressed. And I wrote a few key words here to represent both the group of students that I just described, but also my own high school life. You know, admittingly, I grew up in suburban Salt Lake County. My high school was almost exclusively white. You know, nobody even uttered LGBT. It wasn't a topic, or it wasn't in the common vernacular at the time, just to cite one example. And whenever I would form a study group, maybe in my own high school experience, there was this sense of prestige, or the sense of new enlightenment that comes with having someone in my study group. There's something kind of exotic about having someone who is part of the other, whether they came from another country or had a different life experience rather than just plain suburban life. So somewhere in my comments springs a question. Is it reasonable to be a minority on a topic and to see yourself as well as be seen by others, as if that's something to celebrate? Like, you guys need me in your group. I'm a minority in this way, and I can add value to whatever the group is, whether you're studying an academic topic, a social one, a hard science, a soft science, Sunday school class preparation, whatever the topic is, that the group is actually benefited, enlightened, value added by having you, me, whomever, as a minority within your group.
So let me just make sure I understand the question before I start to talk. You're asking how or why do minorities feel like they are, or shouldn't minorities feel like they are being celebrated when they are sought after by individuals for their contributions to things?
Yeah, can a minority see themselves as someone to celebrate their difference,
uh-huh,
rather than feeling like they're being quashed?
So is it possible?
Yeah, is it possible? And who bears the duty? Does the minority to say, is it the job of the minority to say, look at me, I'm good in this one way, mm-hmm, that you're weak? Or is it the duty of the majority to see themselves as being in an echo chamber, as seeing themselves as a mirror of the guy standing across from them, to say we need to mix things up, even if we have to leave the room and seek a minority,
right,
person to bring into our group?
Right. So I'm going to tell you what I told Grant when I first blamed him. So, how do I explain this? First of all, that your second question, whose responsibility is it? It's both. That's the flat-out answer. It's both. But when I walked into the Reform Honor Code meeting, it was all white people, and I was the only person of color in the room. And so I said, you're all white people, and I'm the only person of color in this room. It's your responsibility to make sure that that's not how it is. And one of their members said to me, it's not our fault because everybody in here made the effort to message Grant and be a part of the planning. And I said, you can't tell me that because I'm a woman of color and I've been pushed in the corner. Like, am I getting this?
No, you're 100%.
Okay, yes. Yep. Corroborated.
I remember it.
That's not allowed, basically, because people of color, especially women of color, have been silenced forever. They still are. And they're told that their contributions are meaningless, unwanted, and unnecessary. So it is the responsibility of people in that echo chamber to go out and say, no, I want your contributions. And that's what people like Evan, Julia, Grant, and, you know, the people who are supporting me have helped me understand, because it's not known. I didn't always know that my voice was valuable and that my voice was needed. Just before this started, I was like having a lot of anxiety tearing up my name tag. And Evan told me and Julia, your experiences are valuable and they need to be communicated. So, and then regarding your first question, where is it possible for minorities to feel celebrated and important? Yes, it is. It's very, very hard to do. And it's, I can't speak for the entire communities or anything, but I think something that also plays into it is what you don't want to do is tokenize minorities, because that's happened to me before. It's happening to me right now. I can tell. We can tell. I came to Sunstone and heard nuanced Mormon community, and I only saw like maybe 10 people of color here. Maybe like 3 disabled people, a few queer people. Like, there is room to grow everywhere, and until we do better, it's possible for minorities to feel celebrated, but it's not the norm. I think this is where, not to go off on a tangent, but cultural appropriation comes from. Just last Halloween, a BYU comedy group posted on their Instagram page a horrifyingly racist picture of a student who was a person of color wearing a sombrero and a poncho. That is cultural appropriation because, first of all, there's so much that goes into this. I'm not safe to be on that campus wearing brown skin. Why does he get to be there wearing a sombrero that's actually my culture, not his? So it's hard for minorities to feel like they can be celebrated when they don't even feel safe, I guess is the answer.
Ultimately, inclusivity has to be about more than just inviting people of color into white spaces. You have to dismantle the spaces and create new ones that aren't based in white supremacy. And the same thing goes for gender. It's not about men inviting women into male spaces. Sorry for stepping on your guys' toes.
No, you're good. I would invite you to read Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Absolutely.
More about that.
It's where we live.
Like, are there particular organizations or online fora or apartment complexes that are cells of dissent? I don't know. I'm a former member of the Underground, so I'm just curious.
Yes. Yeah, we got a few.
Twitter.com?
Yes.
Twitter.
It's Twitter.
Yeah. We were there at the same time.
Oh, really?
Oh, very cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Twitter's the biggest.
So, I think all of us met through Twitter. And we've met most of our like edgy BYU friends from Twitter.
Nuance.
Nuance.
We don't say edgy.
We say nuance. Here at some
wrong buzzword.
Yes.
Twitter was like actually what started my journey into nuanced Mormonism. You know, I was in that agnostic limbo, and seeing that these people, you know, these wonderful people on this panel with me, that they had these nuanced views and that they were able to be Mormon and believed all the things that I believed that had made me leave the church, you know, with like LGBTQ rights, social issues in general, and just like, you know, a lot of the Mormon doctrine, classic history stuff. But these people found ways to make it work. And I thought, okay, maybe that's something that I can do too. I mean, I'm at BYU for 4 years. Why not? Why not dip my toes in it again? And yeah, so I love Twitter. Thank you.
One thing though, I think we all mentioned like our feelings of like aloneness. So it is very hard to find other people who aren't like Orthodox, I guess.
Yeah, I think that you can sometimes find it depending on your program. Like Julia mentioned the arts program. I don't want to expose anyone, but the sociology program is also a great place to find people who have nuanced views.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. English is like 7 out of 10. The English major, it's getting there. It's pretty good. It's pretty solid.
We have 5 minutes left.
Okay. Yeah.
Follow up, also Sub-Q. Segue, and geology program plug.
Really, really?
Several of us are here today.
Geology rocks.
But
sorry. Gosh. Sorry, everyone.
Bye.
I know. I've grown into them early.
Especially, in all programs, there's probably a limited representation of minorities. And with the few friends that I have in my program, and I've discussed them with them about it, and I've discussed the explicit question of how to be different. And I showed up being like, I'm here, I'm different. Listen to me, but nobody cares. And I did have another friend who's Latinx, and she explained how moving into the majority space and expecting to be heard without doing anything to maintain your mental health when you aren't isn't going to work, and you have to, you know, steel yourself and prepare yourself to be alone sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's I think as a graduate student, it's the most hurtful part about it for me is the limitations on academic freedom. We used that term earlier, but it goes into, again, everything be what you should be. Is that the avenue for administrators to see BYU as something besides a dating service? I guess, like, is the academic freedom, the explicit things that BYU says they are, the world is our campus, I forget what the other one is, that's not true. can we tell them that academic freedom is the reason BYU should exist? Is that going to help?
We can definitely.
Jeffrey or Holland already kind of did to start, like, their, you know, things, and it didn't really make a difference, so I don't know. I'm kind of a cynic. Don't ask me questions.
Yeah.
Asking the wrong thing. We're all very cynical.
I've been there for too long.
I think, again, well, I'm finishing my freshman year, so I've still got that spunk a little bit, you know. I'm expecting it to fully be gone by the end of the summer. I don't know. Again, I think that, like, the school will progress, and it will continue to become more progressive, but it'll always be behind. It'll always be at least, like, 10, 20 years behind, and likely more, but I think, I don't know, my way of doing it is I think news media, again, BYU, they don't like to change unless there's an external pressure to do so. They like to keep the status quo. There's just so much bureaucracy. Like, that's the biggest thing that we've noticed, is there's, like, the Honor Code Office director we thought was the guy that we needed to target originally, and then there's seven people above him, you know, he has no power to change anything. Okay. Yeah. I thought I was saying something bad. I thought I needed to be censored. Anyway, that's my thought.
Okay, so when Grant said that, like, he doesn't think it's going to change, I really felt that, because, as we talked about, like, everyone at BYU who's in charge and who's important is a white man, because it's tied to priesthood authority. And so it's not even just in the overarching, like, administration. It's in every single level of the school. My major is 100% female, and we have one female professor. Like, it's bad, because the women in the church aren't getting their PhDs. They're not able to come back and be professors. They're becoming moms, and so they're not continuing in their fields. And so not to be cynical, but I am cynical, because since everything at BYU is tied to priesthood authority, like, I don't see a lot of room for radical change there.
And BYU is not a family-friendly school. I was part of a group that was trying to diversify BYU to BYU faculty, and we narrowed down, like, the reasons why professors don't want to apply and don't get accepted as professors. And it's because women don't come because it's not a family-friendly school. There's no daycare. The birth control healthcare plan sucks.
The same thing applies to graduate students.
Really?
Yeah, applications.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The graduate program, which I think there's a weirdly number of non-LDS graduates in my program, graduate students, there's obvious reasons that it's not attractive to to outside voices.
And athletes, too.
And I, like, to go back to your original question, that, like, will it change based in, like, the favor of, like, academic, you know, freedom? I mean, D. Michael Quinn was a long time ago, but he just spoke the truth, you know? Like, he straight up just did research, academic research, and it was, like, minorly offensive, so I don't know.
That's a little sad of a note to end on.
Well, it's kind of true.
Let's keep it up.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
I wish there was like something we could say that just make it all happy at the end, but it's just like BYU's not there yet.
This is just the reality.
Let this feeling sink in, because this is what BYU is right now.
We're not here to release your tension.
If you're feeling sad, though, just know that there are so many students who kind of believe the same things as us, and so many people who do want to see change. It's just we're limited.
In 1 minute or less, tell me more about microaggression and how it shows itself.
Ooh. There are YouTube videos on this.
Yeah.
I will liken it to a mosquito bite. Everybody has microaggressions that happen against them. It's not unique to minorities. White people have microaggressions against them. If you're disabled, if you're the least bit different. Basically, it can be anything. The boy in my class who told me that I probably eat rice and beans and told me that I was probably on food stamps. Those are microaggressions. That is not outright racism. Or the man who crossed the street when I was walking towards him on the sidewalk. Microaggression. They are small things that do not physically harm me, but like over time build up because it's literally every day that push people who experience them at such an extreme rate to have dramatic outbursts. Typically, at the experience of one. So, to quote Hank Smith, your woman is not mad about what just happened. She is mad about everything that has happened the last, like, month and a half. He was wrong in that context, but that's basically what microaggressions are for. In my experience, yeah, I'm going to yell at a white person for, like, one thing because of the several things that have happened to me. And I'm not going to feel bad about it.
Okay, thank you so much.